Now I have a podcast. Ho, ho, ho.
Thanks for coming back for another episode of Not Suitable for Anyone. As always, I am your host, Patrick Anderson, and we are closing out the month of December with a bang. I've got a really fun episode lined up today and a fantastic guest. I'm really excited about this. I hope you guys have enjoyed these Christmas horror episodes as much as I have enjoyed making them. It's been very exciting for me. And I am almost sad, not almost sad, I am very sad to see it go, unfortunately. But that's okay, because there's more great stuff coming, and there's plenty of non-Christmas stuff to cover as well. This was just a fun little theme that I could, that I was glad I could throw together for everyone. Now, I don't throw around the words instant classic very lightly. Actually, maybe I probably do, but that perfectly describes today's movie. I think it's an instant classic Christmas slasher. It is only a few years old, and I am really excited to talk about it. It is gory, it is bloody, it is mean-spirited, it is chock full of practical effects. It is all through the house, and please join me in welcoming writer-director Todd Nunes.
How's it going?
Pretty good, man. How are you?
Doing great.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for doing this. I'm glad we could make it work.
Absolutely. I love talking about All Through the House, horror movies. It's my thing.
Awesome. That's great. I'm a big fan of the movie. I've probably seen it like three or four times now. It's kind of funny to say that because, you know, like when you're a kid and there was some movie that you loved, you probably watched it like 50 times.
Oh, yeah. You Friday the 13th, like repeatedly.
Yeah. But now, you know, like as an adult, when there's so much more content out there, it's, you're lucky if you can make time to see something twice, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I used to be able to, like, in the first couple of seconds, I could tell you what the movie was without even knowing the title. Just the first couple of seconds. Like, I could never do that now, but it's amazing. Yeah. How much more there is out there.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's certain movies. I'm sure if you're anything like me, like there's certain movies that, you know, somebody could feed you a line from, you know, like halfway through the movie and you could probably recite the rest of it.
Yes. Yes. I've done that before many times.
It drives my wife nuts. I can tell you that. So awesome, man. Cool. Well, I'm glad. I'm glad to have you on. And, like I said, a big fan of All Through the House. If you don't mind, I mean, maybe we can just kind of jump in at a high level. Maybe tell me about, talk a little bit about, the release. This was, this came out like commercially in like 2016 or so, I think.
Yeah. We did the conventions, for about a year. We went to all the horror conventions, we played everywhere. And then it finally came out in 2015. We did really well, like so much better than I ever even thought. We definitely planned to do a lot of things to make it controversial, to make it memorable, to give it an 80s vibe and make the Christmas atmosphere just go, you know, Whoville on everybody with that. hoping that would strike a chord with the audience and people would keep coming back to it, and it worked. So we've been so excited about it.
That's cool. I was gonna say, I mean, that's one of my notes is it sort of hits you, you know, a few minutes into the movie. I mean, this thing is just drenched in Christmas. Like every house, every exterior, every interior, I mean, like everything is just decorated to the nines. It's just dripping in that sort of Christmas energy.
Yeah, I really wanted it to kind of feel like Whoville. I wanted it to feel like Christmas just threw up all over the movie. So that it would be something that people would want to return to every year, because it would give you that feeling, not just, you know, placing a couple of 99 cent store decorations. The Christmas atmosphere was really important.
Yeah, it looked like a lot of work went into that, just like the set design, you know, set decoration and stuff like that. I mean, just, I mean, leaving aside for the fact that it's a movie, if you just think about it being, if you think about that being someone's house, you know, I mean, I've hung Christmas lights with my dad and stuff in the yard, and I know how much work that is just to do, you know, sort of the minimum, and everything is just, it's just really over the top.
Yeah, well, thank you for recognizing that, because yes, the decorating, the I didn't want to see, we did it during the summer. So it was summertime when we did all of this. And then I have Envision lines, in case I'm sounding a little weird, but so my talking is a little off. So it took us, you know, hours to do every scene and to take it down. I didn't want to see it. I couldn't even like deal with the fact that Christmas was here, because I'd spent like half a year. So it ruined Christmas for me for 1 year.
Yeah, I can see, because yeah, I mean, there's so much going on. I took a note, because there's actually a scene where someone has like wrapped like the shower head with tinsel.
Yeah, it's so funny, because so many people bring that up. Like every single time I'm talking about it with someone, they mention that. But the reason for that was because the bathroom was so small and the shower head was metal, you could see me and the cameraman in the reflection of it. And so we decided to wrap some garland around it so that it would block out any reflection of us having to move or see us in there. So that's why that's there.
Okay. Yeah, I was wondering, because, like, you know, my wife loves Christmas and stuff too, but I'm like, that's something I've never done. Like, I've never decorated the shower.
Yeah, it was, we were, you know, you got to come up with creative ideas all the time when you're making a movie, especially with a movie with, you know, little money. You're always running into problems, and you're always having to come up with something on the spot. So that was an example.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, that's what directing and producing is, I guess, a lot of the time. It's just, you know, it's just problem solving.
Yes, it is. It's you go in with plan A, but you got to make sure you have plan B and plan C. Like, most of the movie is plan B, because plan A always had some kind of problem. There was always something going on, but it was okay, because plan B I was in love with just as much. And I think that's important when you go into making a movie, that you don't feel like you've lost something if you've got to revert to a plan B.
Right, right. Yeah, and that's important. Yeah, I think that's important. And it does, I mean, it holds together, because it seems like you had, you know, sort of an overarching, you know, plan of what you wanted it to be. So even if you have to change maybe like the details in how a scene is implemented, you still have the overall, you know, story that you're trying to tell.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit about your influences. I mean, you mentioned Friday the 13th. I think it's clear from watching the movie that you're a big, you know, sort of 80s slasher fan. So I guess, what are some of the more, you know, sort of notable influences that you're sort of working into the film here?
Well, I think you can see a lot of, you know, Friday the 13th and Texas Chainsaw Massacre and all of that in places. But I think that some of the lesser known horror movies that came out around that time that really influenced me, that people don't necessarily connect to, would be like Deadly Blessings was a big movie that I really liked back then. And I think that there was a lot of influence that I brought from that movie. Everybody says Sleepaway Camp, but it really... Really, it was Deadly Blessings. That was the movie that I enjoyed a lot more. I wasn't ever a really big fan of Sleepaway Camp, to be honest with you. And so, along with, you know, everything else is just thrown in there. Night Warning, Butcher Baker, Nightmare Maker. That's another movie that I was influenced by. I really love Susan Terrell in that movie. and you could sort of see her character in the Mrs. Garrett character and all through the house.
Okay. And I guess what made you, because this was your first feature, right? So what made you want to make a Christmas movie?
Well, I've always been obsessed with Christmas because I've always, even as a kid, was sort of fascinated by the darker side of it. You know, Christmas really comes to life at nighttime when the lights are on, and that's when Santa comes, and that's when you're getting excited because the next morning is going to be Christmas. And so it really, nighttime is a big part of Christmas, and with the lights. And I've always felt that there was something creepy about Santa Claus. I mean, I loved Santa Claus. I wanted to sit on his lap, but whenever I saw him, it was a little scary. And I've always thought that that was fun. And even in high school, I did a play about a killer Santa Claus. And I literally
That's cool. And yeah, there is something, especially to a kid, there's something a little creepy about Santa Claus. I mean, even, you know, when you start thinking about, you know, like the words of the song and stuff like that, like he sees you when you're sleeping, you know, all this stuff, like that's freaky. And you think back to, like, you know, a perennial favorite in our house is A Christmas Story. You know, when he goes to see the department store Santa.
Great scene. I love that scene. Yeah. And basically, you know, Santa, he is a stranger, and we're taught at a young age, you know, to stay away from strangers, don't talk to strangers. And all of a sudden here's this stranger that we don't know, that we're not supposed to see, you know, at nighttime. We leave our windows open for him. And our parents are okay with it. So that's.
Yeah. Yeah. It's strange. And, it's funny. I just watched yesterday and today, a double feature of, I watched Rare Exports and Santa's Sleigh.
I love Santa's Sleigh. Yeah.
And it's funny, like never really thought about it before, but there's kind of a thematic connection because in both of those movies, the basically the common theme is that Santa is not what we thought he was. You know, that Santa's actually evil. And like there's different reasons, I guess, that they reveal throughout the movie for, you know, why, why it's coming to light now. But yeah, just kind of a fun twist on that. And so you've got, you know, sort of a Santa themed killer here with the mask and the Santa suit. And you know, and that's sort of what we're following here. So, that's a lot of fun, and it's a really creepy mask. So I guess where did the design of the mask come from?
Well, you know, it wasn't, you know, the screenplay was written. There was an idea of the mask, and then was a lot of work that went into that, because again, we were really thinking about how can we make this movie stand out? What is, you know, the best way of doing that, and importance of a killer. I mean, your villain is the star. And Lito Velasco did an amazing job. And so we had a bunch of different masks. I had Lito trying them on all the time, and we would take photo shoots with it. And it was just when the moment happened, when everything came together with the costume and the mask and all, we just knew it was right. Like, this was the right one. And we did a paint job on it and some other stuff to it. And it was just like, you know, the angels were singing, and it was like, this is it. So it was work to get it done.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah. Well, and, you know, and definitely want to, you know, compliment that, because it is really creepy. And I think, you know, kind of used to great effect, because there's a couple of shots where, like, early in the movie where the mask kind of gets knocked off of a, you know, off of a dummy, or whatever, and you see like the glowing red Christmas lights behind it and stuff, and there's just a lot of cool shots that you're sort of playing with that effect.
Yeah, and when you have a good mask, you're able to. It's a lot of fun because you're able to mess with the lighting, and Lito had a great time playing the part. He did an excellent job without ever showing his face. Everything just came alive. It was a perfect storm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. Okay. So, yeah, I want to get into some of the details on this, because the movie's been out for a few years now, and it's real easy to find. I think so. I think people should definitely go and watch it, especially if you want to go in fresh and you don't want to be, you know, spoiled by any of the kills and stuff. I want to get into a lot of the kills and stuff, because there's a lot. There's a big body count in this movie.
Yes, that was important too.
Yeah, so definitely you've been warned. Go check out the movie. I think it's on Amazon Prime and Tubi TV. It's a lot of places. You know, I think it's you can rent it. There's a lot of outlets out there for it. Is there a particular version or place that you like to refer people or prefer that they catch it?
No, anybody's welcome to catch it wherever you can. I know right now for sure that the places that you just mentioned. I think we're on, I don't know, is it Shudder or another horror streaming site, and we're on some cable networks. So it's out there. It's all around. iTunes, just about everything.
Okay, awesome. Awesome. Yeah, because there are yeah, like I said, there's a big body count here, and I feel like that was important to you for the movie. I mean, you wanted it's a slasher, and the kills really take center stage.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a fan. This is what, you know, this is what I grew up with, and when I watch some horror movies today, and you just see somebody scream, a character that you've been following this whole time, and then they just scream off stage and there's some blood splattered on the wall, you kind of feel cheated. And it's not fun, because it's part of what a slasher is. So that was very important. In fact, we had a very low budget, but half of our budget went to special effects. So we threw it all into that.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And you can definitely tell, because like you said, you don't really mask or hide a lot of the kills. We get actual penetration, and stuff in it, and pretty close in good lighting. I mean, that's kind of one of my pet peeves too, is when, you know, they film a bunch of stuff and because they don't have a good budget for effects, you know, everything's sort of shrouded in the dark, so you can't really see what's happening.
So real quick, and you can't see exactly, and I didn't want any of that. I wanted to be there. I wanted it to be showcased.
Yeah, and the other thing is, this movie is mean. Like, there are, you know, no one is really spared here, including some of the family pets.
Yeah, which is really interesting, because we have all these people getting killed, kid and grandma, but it wasn't until you kill the cat that everybody in the audience screams. So I find that very interesting.
Yeah.
So the dog and the cat off screen. No one has to be subjected to that.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Yeah, I do want to point that out. If that's a trigger for some people, I think the pet, both pets are killed off screen, but you do hear it, or you hear, yeah. So and the dog was, is the dog named Sugar Balls?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, there was actually a little bit of a scene before that set up that character and the dog. But because we were trying to really condense the film down to make it, real fast, and we had to cut that out. So it's like there was a setup. But yeah, it is funny that this dog just comes in named the Sugar Balls.
So that's fun. And the other thing that I kind of noticed is, all the kills are unique. Even if some of the same, tools are used, I mean, he's using them in different ways at least. So it's not just sort of the same, stab to the gut or stab to the chest or something every time. Like each person sort of meets a different fate.
Yeah, and we took it seriously. We wanted each thing to be shocking, unexpected, and different from the last. So that you're always wondering, well, what's going to be next? You're waiting for the next kill, and it's not just going to be a stab. We're going to do something different.
Right. Yeah. And so you've got the first couple There's a couple of these just these interludes of, you know, people just sort of in their homes. You have, you know, the babysitter and the boyfriend that comes over in the beginning, and that's those first couple of kills is you know, when you see our killer is, you know, taking his, you know, his garden shears, and, you know, he's just cutting off people's dicks. Left, and that may be like the one sort of commonality between, you know, some of the kills.
You better watch out.
And I guess that's where, we gave a spoiler warning. So I guess, you know, that's where, you know, some of the, I guess a lot of the Sleepaway Camp, comparisons probably come in because of this character. It's kind of an Angela type situation. It was part of that, I guess, you know, kind of trying to, you know, create a little controversy, or, you know, what's the.
Yeah, absolutely. It was controversy, and it was also just trying to come up with an idea for a serial killer that had some type of motivation that hadn't been done before. You know, it's like people, you know, still to this day talk about the Christmas movie where the Santa has a bag of dicks, and it's crass and all of that, but it's also funny, and it makes people to say, "What? Well, I got to see that movie." So it is to be controversial. It is to get people talking about it, but it's also to have a killer that's doing something that no other killer has done.
Yeah. For sure. Cause that's not something that, that you see often. And another kudos to, you know, the prosthetics work on the severed dicks, because that's another, you know, sort of fun element here.
Yeah, and there was a lot of talk about, like, at first, you know, when it was being written, and I like the idea, I like the concept, but I'm like, but we're not going to show anything like that. We're just going to, you know, we will imply it, but we're just not one thing heavily show. But that went all out the window, and the producers were like, no, we want to see it. You know, when I show, they open the bag, and he's showing his mother, you know, they're like, no, we want to see what's in the bag. So I had to. I would film things, and I'd say, well, we're never going to use this because it's too much. And, you know, of course, it all got put into the movie, just adding to its charm.
It does. I mean, it is because the one that gets me all the time that makes me laugh every time I watch it is, you know, there's and that explains, I guess, why you've got the insert shots of the severed dicks, like, hitting the floor and whatever. And there's one of them where the cat comes over.
Yeah, that exactly was spur of the moment. I asked the person who was there, because their cat kept coming in and seeing it on the floor and sniffing it. And we took a cat tree and we stuck it inside there and waited patiently, the cameraman, until we got the shot. And I'm like, we're never going to use this, but let's get it anyways. No, there it is.
Yeah, but you use it, and then you immediately cut to one of the girls eating a hot dog. that's just one of my favorites. It's just one of my favorite shots. At one point there's some dialogue, I guess, to kind of like drive home the fact that he's collecting these severed dicks.
Yeah.
Because the girls start having this conversation about collections, and it's my favorite line from the whole movie is, you know, what about your collection of Beanie Babies and STDs?
Yeah, and that's one of those things that, you know, there was no like, oh my gosh, what am I going to say here? It was just like, that just came out, and there it was, and it was it became a very popular line in the movie.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. And so there's a sequence. Actually, before we get there, so we talked about the severed dick and the cat and the hot dog, and then some in between. At this point, we've got a few scenes of Mrs. Garrett kind of establishing her character. She's not all there either.
Nope.
And she's got all these mannequins all over her house. It kind of reminded me a little bit of Maniac.
Maniac. Oh, absolutely. I'm sure I was Maniac. That was another. That's a great movie.
Yeah, because she's having conversations with you know, with all these mannequin people, and that stuff is just sort of genuinely disturbing and creepy.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I always thought that the mannequins in the stores were always creepy. And I think they're even making more mannequins now, but they don't have faces anymore because of that. And it was really hard for us to find mannequins that actually had faces. The ones that we were, you know, available or whatever, they were just like these blank, like alien things. No nose or anything.
Right. But they used to have faces and expressions. Yeah. And there was another great 80s movie, a mannequin. Actually, they made two mannequins about the mannequin coming to life.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that one was a comedy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, right.
But then the next set piece you have with one of the girls in bed with the shears coming up, you know, through the mattress, which is a really, really terrifying sequence. You know, a lot of the movie is, you know, it's definitely very much an homage to those 80s slashers, and it's fun to watch, you know, and it's not, you know, it's not scary in the traditional sense, but this is one of those scenes that's really, you know, that's really, truly terrifying.
Most people, there's like a space underneath your bed, and there's always that feeling of when you're a kid, you know, running and jumping onto your bed because you're afraid something's going to come out and grab you. So it's just sort of playing into that.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's put together really well, I think, and, you know, and edited really well. Cause like I said, like that's kind of the moment where, you know, you're like my heart just starts beating just a little bit faster.
Yeah. It's a bad situation to be in.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And so, you know, and then, so we're sort of finding out a little bit of backstory this whole time about Rachel and, you know, and her mom. She seems to have been raised by her grandmother. You know, we don't really find out right away, you know, what happened to her mom. And there's this whole mystery with Mrs. Garrett and her daughter Jamie that is sort of presented, but it's not really explained. You kind of have to, you know, sort of pick up the pieces as you go along.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it's always a lot more fun to piece it together yourself instead of somebody just telling you exactly what's going on. Cause then you're sort of following along with the main character because she's piecing it all together too.
Right. And I think if you were sort of focused on someone, like, you know, actively unraveling this mystery, then it might sort of distract from the kills and the set pieces that you have, which are, again, really, I guess, like the whole point of the movie. So you're not even necessarily expecting it to have this mystery aspect to it until it's sort of unveiled as the, you know, as the final act unfolds.
Yeah. Yeah. That's when everything just goes bonkers. I love a bonkers third act. A lot of times movies sort of like there's a pattern where, you know, then there's a final chase at the end. And I try not to do that. Like I put the chase a little bit, you know, earlier and then have other stuff that happens at the end so that everything really gets paid off in a big, fun way.
Right. Yeah, because the really it's sort of the end of the second act is where you're sort of chasing Rachel, you know, through the house. And this is another really tense sequence because there's a lot of cat and mouse here where she's in the house, she's running out of the house and back in the house and, like, you know, trying to get away, and, you know, is the killer gonna catch her?
Yeah, well, one of my favorite things about slasher movies are the chase scenes. I love a good chase scene. It is one of my favorites. And Friday the 13th Part 3 in 3D with Dana Kimmel and Richard Brooker. I love that chase scene. It went on and on and on. And it never ended. Each little segment was worked out perfectly to, you know, almost get and then get away. And I thought that was done extremely well. I love the chase scene.
And you've got a good one here because it is very tense. And you know, and you don't exactly know what's going to happen or how it's going to play out, and that just makes it more fun because you kind of feel like this is another one of those movies where, you know, you you don't really at this point, you know, we're sort of down to the final girl at this point, and you know, in story wise the movie should be almost over, but there's, you know, there's still a good 20 minutes left.
You got a boyfriend.
Right.
Oh yeah, what's going to happen with him, right?
Yeah. Exactly. I almost forgot about that. Yeah, we bring bring the boyfriend back in.
Be the boyfriend in this movie, the final guy.
Yeah. So he comes in, and of course he doesn't end up saving the day.
No, of course not. Horror movies. I believe that horror movies are the action movie of females. I believe this is their action movie. This is where they're the star, and I love that about this. And if I want to see that, I can watch, you know, Rambo and James Bond, you know. But I think this is where the Jamie Lee Curtis started the whole thing, and she's the star of her show. So yeah, definitely Rachel, my sister, is a star.
Yeah, for sure. And that's a fun aspect of these, because you're right in that, you know, we don't, outside of horror, until recently, you didn't really see, you know, sort of women in those, you know, in the sort of prominent roles. I think that's what makes, movies like I Spit on Your Grave, you know, for all of their faults, it's one of the things that makes them interesting. And you know, what draws people to them is sort of seeing someone in that kind of, you know, revenge role, or sort of taking charge of their situation.
Yeah, and probably part of the reason why there's a huge fan base of women who love horror movies, probably just as much as the guys, and I think that has a lot to do with it. That, you know, especially in the 80s when this started coming out, we really didn't see, you know, Die Hard with a woman or Rambo with a woman. We see a lot of that today, but back then, not so much. And I think that's helped shape slasher movies to what they are today. You're always looking for a great female hero in a slasher movie.
Yeah. And you have, and so you have one here, and I think she's actually has got some acting awards at some of the festivals.
She's won other acting awards. She was nominated for Best Actress, Action on Film, which wasn't even a horror convention, which was great. And so she has a lot of other stuff that she's doing. And I think she did great. She loves chase scenes and fighting and the physical part. So that for a director, and that's the kind of actor that you want, somebody who's not, you know, afraid to get messy.
Yeah, for sure. She is, she's doing a lot of work, especially in this final act, just sort of physically.
Yeah, right. It was on her shoulders. If she, you know, couldn't come through with it, what would the third act be without, you know, her being able to rise to the occasion? And so she had to do that as an actress as well, and sort of had all of this on her shoulders, because if you don't care about her, then you're not going to care about the movie.
Right. Yeah. And she's doing all of this in heels. You know, she's jumping through windows and running, you know, running through the yard and stuff. And, you know, and she's in this kind of like ridiculous, like Alice in Wonderland type dress.
Yeah. So yeah, no, she had a blast with it.
Yeah. But then you managed to, I'm trying to think of the word I'm looking for, but you're kind of subverting expectations here too, because if you're following the strict slasher formula, you know, there's going to be this chase scene. She's going to get the upper hand, and then she's going to, you know, she's going to take out the killer. But it unfolds actually a little bit differently. So I guess talk about, you know, sort of how, and, you know, you decided to, you know, to sort of go that direction instead of a more, you know, conventional route.
Well, because, you know, it's like people want to see, they want that flavor, the 80s flavor, but it can't be completely the same. You've got to throw in some twists and turns and make those twists and turns feel like they're still a part of it, like you're not trying to make it, you know, millennial horror or slasher, that you're still being loyal to the 80s version, if that's what you're doing, and that's what I'm doing with this. But I didn't want to stick so close to it that you would be able to call what's going to happen, you know, in the next scene, or how this whole thing is going to play out, and that she's going to kill him, and then she's going to walk away, and his eyes are going to open at the end. Like, I you know, those are all great things, but I think you've got to play around with it a little bit to make it feel like it's something you haven't seen before. It's something that you've felt before. You want that feeling of the 80s movie, but you don't want to necessarily have it be a complete, you know, paint by the numbers.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that makes a lot of sense. Because you're right, is in that it does have that feeling, but you know, there are still some surprises, and they're not like cheap surprises. I mean, everything that's sort of come before, it feels like a very, you know, sort of natural way for all of those situations to resolve themselves. Like nothing really feels forced. You know, there's not, you know, just some hand reaching in from, you know, from the fourth wall and saving the day. I mean, it all sort of flows organically, sort of given what we know, you know, up to that point.
So yeah, it's about just making sure that everything you've set up is you pay off. So it's really great to sort of look at your story backwards, and if you're having these big moments and you want to do these things, and then to make sure that you go back and you set that all up so it's a nice flow to your big moments, and it feels organic.
Yeah, for sure. So the other thing, you know, that I kind of wanted to touch on a little bit here is the music in the film, because you've got a very, you know, sort of this very intense, very serious sort of orchestral score, you know, sort of underlying the whole film and really, you know, sort of setting the tone and setting the mood here.
Yeah. And there was a lot of talk about exactly how the music was going to be, because of course, you know, I think that a lot of people who do Christmas slasher movies, the instinct is to make that score have a Christmas sort of flavor to it. And I didn't want to do that for this because I felt like there was so much Christmas in every shot. In fact, it's like every shot there's Christmas, and we made sure of that. So I felt it was okay to sort of stray from that and just go for a really great soundtrack that would make it so that you could watch this all year long if you wanted to. And it's not so, you know, puking Christmas.
And it doesn't feel gimmicky. You know, we mentioned Santa's Sleigh a little bit earlier. I mean, I think that's one where they do sort of weave in a lot of Christmas carols and things like that into the story. And, you know, and I love that movie, and I'm not disparaging it in the least. But it definitely, you know, sort of has that. And I think that's the vibe it's going for. Like, it wants to be this kind of like gimmicky fun, you know, Christmas movie, this ridiculous thing with Bill Goldberg, you know, smashing people. But you're obviously going for a very different kind of tone here.
Yeah, because I've always wanted I want the movie to stand out, because I knew that there was going to be a wave of Christmas movies coming. And I knew that I was just sort of a little bit ahead before it was going to explode. And it really has. We've got so many Christmas horror movies and slasher movies, and I love them all. But I wanted to make sure that this one would stand out, that people would keep coming back to it every year. And that was part of another reason why I decided to go with the music. So it just really feels like a different flavor than all the others.
I think it really does. And yeah, and I, you know, the words instant classic, I think, come to mind when I, you know, when I saw this, I think last year for the first time.
Well, I appreciate that. Those are great words. Thank you.
Because you don't, you know, it's one of those, you know, I like Christmas horror, but I like movies that are, you know, that are on the meaner side. Mm-hmm. I think that's just a little more fun. You know, it's not one of those where they're going to wake up and everything's fine at the end.
Well, you know, it is fun, and you can be nastier and meaner when you're doing a movie where you're having a little bit more fun with it. It's nasty and it's mean, but you know, it's easier to digest it when you're building it around, you know, all this Christmas and this, you know, crazy story and this crazy Santa Claus. And I think it gives it a lot of flavor.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you think back to like some of the classic, you know, Christmas slashers, you're going all the way back to even Black Christmas from the 70s.
Yeah. Well, Black Christmas, that's one of my favorite Christmas horror movies and movies on my list. I love that movie.
Yeah, and even that one, you know, I mean, there may be, I don't remember, like, there may be, like, some, you know, some scenes, you know, here or there where, you know, where someone's listening to Christmas music, but when you hear the actual soundtrack of the movie, the score, you know, is just, again, this orchestral sort of tense music, and it's not, you know, it's not playful at all.
It's very dark, and then you got the remake that came out after that, which was all color and Christmas, and again with the Christmas sort of themed music and everything. And I wasn't a big fan of it when it first came out, but now I'm kind of like, you know, I enjoy it. I didn't like this third remake that they had. I felt was really disappointing. But I don't think anything's ever going to top the first Black Christmas.
Yeah, I think so. I'm a fan of the 2006 remake. I think you know, is it as good as the original Black Christmas? No, not by a long shot. But I also think that if they had tried to, you know, sort of recapture that same mood, I think it would have fallen flat.
Yeah, I don't think you probably can't do it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you absolutely, you have to. I mean, we're working on a movie right now, which is based on the remake of Don't Look in the Basement. And so, yeah, I mean, you don't want to give the same thing. You want it to have that same sort of feel. You want it to make sure that people feel like they're watching something that's come from their favorite movie or a movie that they enjoy, and give a little bit, like a real good example is a remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre and with Jessica Biel. And I really liked that movie. And I thought that they did a really good job. And it was different than the original, but they gave you enough to where you had the feeling, you felt like you were watching the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and I think that's what's important when doing a remake.
And there have been, you know, a lot of remakes, you know, recently, and you know, and to varying degrees of success, but you know, the more successful ones, I think, you know, don't, you know, they're not trying to just, you know, they're not trying to just retread what's already been done. And I think like, you know, like Gus Van Sant's Psycho or something, which granted, that was actually exactly the point. Let's literally take this script and reshoot it. And I think like there's a reason you don't do that, especially, you know, decades later.
Yeah. Because I'm not sure if that worked. Right. I don't think that anyone who saw that movie, in fact, my sister, I remember her coming back after she saw the movie and she didn't like it at all, and she'd never seen Psycho. So I'm like, we're watching Psycho. See how it's supposed to be done.
Yeah. Well, what makes Psycho great to me, because I think watching it in a 2020, with a 2020 lens and a 2020 mindset, and just watching the story in today's context is not great. The story feels a little, you know, a little stale. The psychology in it is extremely outdated. And it just doesn't work. But what makes it hold up and what makes it great is, you know, just the way that Hitchcock creates suspense in those scenes, you know, his editing, his cinematography, sort of the way we see, you know, Janet Leigh, you know, sort of go from, you know, the hotel room to work to, you know, going on the run and you know, slowly realizing what's happening.
Yeah.
You know, that's what makes it work. It's not the actual story itself. So when you try to tell the exact same story, you know, 30 years later, you know, people are like, no, this doesn't work at all.
Like that. Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. I just thought that it was a bad idea from the beginning.
Yeah. So, but yeah, and I did see the last year's Black Christmas, and again I respect it for again going a very different direction. You know, they might as well have not called it Black Christmas, because
I wish they wouldn't have called it Black Christmas. Like, I think maybe it would have been received better had it not, you know, like been that like that, because again, it's an example of a movie that did not have the feel of the original Black Christmas to make you. You know, you can doing different things, okay, but I think it really needs to come from that place.
Right, yeah. Yeah, Child's Play was one that I enjoyed, and actually the original Child's Play is another Christmas movie, and that was one where they did go a very different direction with the story, but it's still there were still things about it that felt like Child's Play, even though it wasn't Mancini's script at all.
Yeah, and I appreciated it too, and I think that's what I think it did pretty well. I think a lot of people liked it. I'm interested if they're going to have a sequel, or they're doing something, a series or something, or so we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, well, there's a weird thing where Orion or one of the studios sort of owns the rights to the first film, but not to any of the sequels. And Mancini has the rights to the sequels and sort of the Chucky character that's been developed. So, yeah, he's developing a Chucky TV series that's separate. That's supposed to be a continuation of. I'm sure that was the last one was Cult of Chucky.
Yeah,
I think they have the one where they were in the mental institution, and there's all the all the Chuckies at the end.
Yeah, that was interesting too.
So they're making a TV series that's supposed to be a sort of a continuation of that story. And then the Orion film, I think, was successful enough that, I don't know, they may end up doing another one.
Yeah, I think that it's definitely opens it up to a lot of different possibilities. So I think a lot of stuff that could be a lot of fun. So I'm interested to see where it goes.
Yeah. Same here.
But I'm more interested in following the Halloween movies.
That's another interesting one. You know, and that's what's I don't know if it started this trend or if the trend was already there where they're sort of you know, sort of rebooting or retconning away all the sequels, and on the one hand, it is a way to sort of not to free yourself of the burden of this timeline, because. You know, when you go back and watch, you know, 80s horror sequels, I kind of respect that today, like, they're really trying hard to make the continuity make sense.
Yeah.
Because in the 80s, man, they just did not care.
Yeah, they didn't care. And the connections to the movies were very sort of vague. And it wasn't really a new story. It was really just like, you know, even though I love the first... especially the first four Friday the 13th. Really, it was just Jason doing the same thing, you know, over and over again. Yeah. So today, that wouldn't fly. Today, we probably need a little bit more.
Yeah. Because it's like you have, you know, Jason's like a little kid at the end of Friday the 13th. And then, you know, part two literally takes place a year later. You know,
yeah,
but
he can walk to the city unnoticed and come back, you know, and we don't care. We just want to see him kill people.
Right. Yeah. It's one of the things where, like, you know, people complain about continuity in the Saw movies, but I'm like, at least they're trying. They're trying too hard. I think, you know, they're like bending over backwards to try and you know, and they're like reshooting scenes for and showing you like the scene that you saw in Saw 2. You know, 4 years ago, but from a different angle. And this person was there the whole time. I'm like, no, they weren't. But at least they're trying something.
Yeah, they're trying to explain.
So, yeah. So that's fun. Yeah, somewhere along the line, things kind of changed. You know, we talked about this, you know, touched on this a little bit in some other episodes. You know, they used to recap, like half the movie in the sequel. Yeah. And I guess because they didn't want to lose... their audience, they wanted to grow their audience from 1 to 2, but back then, like, you didn't have 24-hour streaming services where anybody could just go watch the original film. You know, if you didn't see it when it was in theaters,
yeah, you didn't see it.
You didn't see it.
HBO, right? They had HBO.
Yeah.
And DHS, or I guess that was a little bit later on. But yeah, I don't know why they did recaps. They're pretty easy to follow, even if you hadn't seen the ones before.
Yeah. No, exactly. Yeah, and I've done that before. I've just jumped into movies, and I'm like, you know what? I'm sure that they're still gonna, you know, I'm sure they're still gonna make this coherent. You know,
and if something doesn't make sense, you just are like, oh yeah, that's probably something that, you know, they explained and I missed it.
Right, right. Yeah. So I know somebody who like started the Alien franchise with Alien 3. Like that was the.
Alien 3, yeah, I was just reminded about that Alien 3 today. And I saw the beginning of it, and I was like, I've seen it once. I'm so angry with Aliens 3.
I think
it's coming from Aliens, right?
Yeah.
Which was like so amazing.
Yeah. I think if you had never seen Aliens, though, like, I think that, you know, like the beginning of Alien 3 probably doesn't have that same effect on you.
Yeah. I think that's probably a really good point, because Aliens was an Alien too, was such great movies, and Aliens was, I mean, there was nothing better than Aliens at that point. And then yeah, it didn't live up. It's a hard act to follow.
Right, right. Yeah, it is tough. Yeah, we had this, I was talking to Luke over at Modern Horrors, because I decided to finish out the rest of the Silent Night, Deadly Night franchise.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. I'm not like a terribly big fan of the first two, but I'm like, well, I'll watch the rest of them just to cross them off the list. And he was like, yeah, you know, typically franchises get better in the third through fifth movie. And that's another one that went off the rails in a big way.
Yeah, it really did. It went all over the place. But yeah, for a movie that was supposed to be banded, so it's pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. It seemed like such a simple formula at first. Like just give me Ricky in a Santa suit killing people. That's not so hard. But somehow they were like, we're gonna throw in, you know, telepathy and.
Oh yeah, and toys, right?
The Mickey Rooney and the toys.
Which was funny because he was such a adamant, so against the first Silent Night, Deadly Night. He was on TV, he was condemning it, and then all of a sudden he's like in one of the movies. I just think that's fascinating.
Yeah. It really is. I guess it's just, you know, you can have all the morals and ideals that you want until it's time to get a paycheck.
Yeah, right.
Everyone's got to eat, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it was, I guess, the way they advertised it. I think that probably they pushed it a little bit over when they showed advertisements, you know, during kids' time and stuff like that. I think they probably could have done it. I don't know. Back then, it would have been. It still probably would have been hard.
Before I let you go, I did want to ask you about Death Ward, and when, how that's coming along, when we might see that.
Yeah. Well, with right now with the COVID, we were getting so close. We had all our ducks in a row, and then COVID hit, and it really threw everything into turmoil. A lot of our investors were backed out because, you know, it's different when you're making a big movie with a lot of money and somebody gets sick, then you shut it down and you wait for them to get better. And then you go back to work. Like here, you know, somebody gets sick and you lose all your money. And it was unfortunate. And I just came from a meeting today and we've got things back on track, so we're still hoping to get it together. Like we're planning with the vaccine and all of that, and hopefully that's going to come into play and will help us out a little bit more, so we can get things back up and running. But it's real difficult for a movie with not a big budget to film at this time.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. Because yeah,
if you get a location and somebody gets sick, you lose that location.
Right.
You lose that money. It's gone.
Yeah.
So it's scary.
Yeah. And you finally sort of get everyone scheduled together, and then one person can't make it, and so you have to reschedule the whole thing. And now you have to go and get, you know, 30 people all, you know, coordinated again on the same day. Or
yeah, it's crazy. But I mean, I think we're coming to the end of it. I think we're at a good place where we're hopefully going to get things together this coming year. So, I mean, we've got a lot of stuff already there and ready to go because we've been planning for so long. We just have to rebuild a lot of stuff that we lost because of the COVID. And that's where we're at right now.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. But yeah, I mean, I'm hearing that a lot lately. I mean, it knocked the big guys offline for a while. And so I'm just thinking about all the, you know, all the independent films that may never see the light of day.
No, because a lot of people investing in independent films are absolutely terrified. They're pulling out of those projects because, like I said, there's not a lot of money to pull from if happens to be something that comes up. Your star goes down, which is, there's a chance it can happen, then your whole production goes down.
Yeah. What do you think about, sort of when COVID is all over, you know, is there going to be a shift towards smaller films? You know, you've got WB, you know, committing their whole 2021 slate to a streaming service. Are there going to be fewer, you know, are there going to be fewer $200, $300 million blockbusters and more, you know, $5 and $10 million films?
I think that they're... will be once people are comfortable about putting their money into films, smaller films. I think there's going to be a lot. I mean, right now, content is king. I mean, all these streaming services, everywhere, everybody wants content. The more content you have, the better. So that's always going to be in demand. It's just the right time. So I think we're going to see a surge of content when things are better. I think everybody's going to run out and start trying to be the first, you know, to get their stuff done. I mean, we are on the sidelines waiting for that moment so that we can be some of the first to come back and be ahead of the onslaught. But I definitely miss the theater big time.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I think The Hunt was the last thing I saw in theaters.
Yeah, I can't even like the thought. It's very sad.
Yeah, yeah, and that's a shame. Drive-ins were making a comeback over the summer.
Yeah, and it's interesting. It would be neat to do a festival or whatever with a movie, especially a movie with like Death War 13 at a drive-in, because you know the first year is us going everywhere, going to theaters and showing the movie. The fans and having that experience with is amazing. It's like one of the best parts of making a movie, and that's probably not, you know, in the cards if, you know, depending on what time we have the movie come out.
Yeah. So what kind of movie is? I mean, it sounds from the title, it sort of sounds like another, you know, sort of 70s or 80s, you know, sort of grindhouse slasher type of film.
Well, it's more of a 70s kind of vibe to it, but it's not, it's totally different than All Through the House, and it's not going to be the same type of movie where it's a little bit grittier. Probably people would call it a little bit more serious than All Through the House. So, but it's still a lot of fun, and it's still going to be gory, and you can expect a plenty of scares and action.
Awesome, cool.
A lot of great, crazy characters.
That's great. That sounds like fun. I'm definitely looking forward to that. And you know, wish you sort of the best of luck in sort
Thank
of getting
you.
That getting that over the finish line. So, Todd, where can people sort of find you online, follow you, sort of keep up with your work?
Well, I'm on Facebook, Todd Nunes, and you can catch me on Twitter at Todd Nunes, and on Instagram at The Real Todd Nunes. And I think those are the three main platforms.
Okay. All right, great. Well, Todd, listen, I really appreciate your time this evening. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for talking with me.
Yeah, thank you. I'm a big, again, like I said, big fan of the movie. I love, you know, sort of these smaller independent films. I created a whole podcast just, you know, sort of dedicated to, you know, to movies that are, you know, sort of flying under the radar and, you know, trying to, you know, bring more awareness and more attention to them. So
we all appreciate that from you. Thank you so much.
Thanks everyone out there also for listening and following along. I hope you enjoy this Christmas run. Like I said, it's been a lot of fun. I want to thank all of my guests over this past run: ABL Brune, John Rocco, Misty Talley, and even an appearance from the one and only Owen Edgerton, along with, of course, Todd Nunes, you all just heard from. I've had a blast. Thank you very much again to Free Parking and Brandon Steer for use of their song Christmas Alone. Please check them out on Twitter and on Bandcamp. I will put links in the show notes to that. So thanks a lot, Tadas, and I really appreciate it. Take care, man.
All right, you take care too. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Thank you very much. I love you guys. Merry Christmas.